Right.
Okay. Good evening. So here we are looking at the beginning of chapter 4 of Bereshit, of Genesis. Adam and Eve have unfortunately been driven out of the Garden of Eden.
Do we need more light for you, Tali? Because we have a lamp there. We've always forget to put it at the last minute. Could we, Alan? Thank you. I think you won't be able to read like that. So sorry, I tell you.
Right, okay. So, yes, it's the illumination of the Garden. Right. So, although in the last text that we read, Adam and Eve were in fact driven out of the Garden of Eden, and we now come to this verse at the beginning of chapter 4, Vaha'adam yada et chava ishto. Man, that means Adam, and Adam knew Eve, his wife. Now, before we go into anything more about the use of the word know, knowledge, yada, for intimacy between husband and wife, there's just something we have to deal with about the tense of this word. And according to the way that Rashi interprets it, we would translate this, and Adam had known Eve, his wife. You see, if it would just be saying, and Adam knew Eve, as the next thing in the series, Adam and Eve were driven out of the Garden of Eden in the previous verse, and then Adam knew Eve, the normal Hebrew way of writing that would be
Vayada.
Vayeda. Yes, it would be with the Vav HaHipuch, the Vav which changes, an interesting feature of classical Hebrew, of biblical Hebrew, that by putting a Vav, and, in front of the verb, it changes the tense. So, Vayeda means, and he knew, whereas Yeda means he will know. Yada means he knew, and V'yada means and he will know. So it's the Vav HaHipuch, it's called in grammatical terminology. So modern grammatical terminology. So but here it's V'adam Yada, it doesn't use that form. And so Rashi understands this as meaning he had known Eve before everything that we read about in the previous few lines with the snake, because remember the reason why the snake became jealous, that's Rashi's reading and the Midrash.
Go on. Saw them making love.
Yeah. Saw them making love. Yeah. Saw Adam and Eve making love. So there they were in the Garden of Eden making love. Yeah. And in fact, the way that Rashi sees it, the whole not only Kva kodem ha'inyan shel ma'ala. Va'adam yada, Adam knew or had known before the subject which was spoken about before, kodem shechata, before he sinned, v'nitchad migan Eden, and was driven out of the Garden of Eden. V'chein ha'hereyon v'haleda, and similarly the pregnancy and the birth. She'im katuv, because if it would have been written Vayeda Adam, and Adam knew, then it would be Nishma Shalacha Shinitrad Hayula Vanim. After he was driven out, he had children. But in fact, it is before. So that means it must have been a very quick pregnancy. Right? no time for prenatal counseling and learning, this method or that method. And that the subtext of that is the idea that after they sinned, then having children became a more problematic or more, certainly more of a business in terms of carrying a child for 9 months. There are concepts in the Midrash that in the future, when the Messiah comes, a woman will be able to give birth every day, so lots of children. So here we have the idea of Adam and Eve making love, Vataha Vateled et Kayin. And so Adam had known Eve, Ishto, his wife, Vataha, and she became pregnant, Vateled et Kayin, she gave birth to Kayin, Cain in English, Vatoman, she said, Kaniti Ish et Hashem, I have acquired a man from God. So our translator over here, you notice Aria Kaplan, I've gained a man with God, she says. Now this Kala acquired or gained somehow this the divine element here is being stressed, and in fact that's where we come back to this verb yada. Yada is a very knowing is a very interesting word for describing intimacy between husband and wife, and in a sense this is much of what we are learning here in Bereshit, in Genesis, about creation, is about man and woman. And the bond between man and woman is something which potentially is extremely profound. And knowledge is, in terms of the nature of the mind, there are three aspects of the mind. And here we'll use this also over here. On the right we have wisdom, chokhmah, and on the left is, I'll just write it in Hebrew, bina, understanding,
and daat.
And then daat is in the middle, and daat represents knowledge. Now we then have other sfirot such as kindness, severity, the central mercy, and then the lower sfirot. But this quality of da'at, of knowledge, it's more than knowledge. Knowledge is not enough. The word knowledge is insufficient to express the word da'at. Da'at means the kind of knowledge which is a commitment, the kind of knowledge which takes with it caring. And there is a story which illustrates the difference between knowledge which is with caring and knowledge which is without caring. The story is set in some Russian shtetl, a little village, and there is a simple man who can't read, but he receives a letter, and the problem is he doesn't know how to read, so he takes the letter to someone or other who is able to read. Maybe it's the rabbi, maybe it's some official, a learned man who is able to read the letter. So they open the letter, and the man who can read starts reading the letter. And the letter tells the recipient, dear Alexis, whatever his name is, I'm terribly sorry, I must tell you, his father has passed away. And the man reading the letter just reads it in an impassive voice. Maybe he feels sorry for the person. But the person who is listening faints. He's so upset. His father's passed away. What? His father's passed away. And he faints. So they're both hearing the same text. To one it matters, and to the other one it's just he's reading a letter. So that's da'at. Da'at means knowledge which cares. It's reading the letter, and it's about you and me. And so it's that kind of knowledge which is the bonding between Adam and Eve in such a way that it causes the birth, in this case the birth of children, that's between husband and wife, the internal structure of a person requires that, because at this level we have mind, this is the level of mind, and then on the lower level we have emotion. And so the bonding of the mind within itself needs the quality of da'at, of knowledge, of a knowledge which cares, a commitment. And then the bonding of the mind to the emotion also needs that quality. So all the way through, this quality of da'at is something very crucial. And it's here, right at the beginning of creation, it's introduced to us at the beginning of creation as the function which relates Adam and Eve to each other in order to bring children into the world. And that power of bringing children into the world is a supremely an amazing quality within human beings, to be able to reach, as it were, into the realms of the infinite and draw down a soul into this world. And it's an essential aspect of life, and when we're talking about human beings, this is a soul, it is a soul with all kinds of aspects to it, which is being drawn into the world. And the interesting thing about the teachings of the sages is that intimacy is recommended throughout life. There is in fact a phrase, whether in the morning or the evening, do not cease. In other words, intimacy between husband and wife is always recommended, and that has a spiritual power. It's always got a spiritual power and a spiritual effect. In some way, it draws some kind of spirituality into the world, even if the woman is pregnant at that time or if she's long past childbearing. But nonetheless, there is a some kind of spiritual transaction taking place between the man, the woman, and the divine. And we see that in this verse as well. Kaniti ish et Hashem. I have acquired a man with God. Now Rashi, in fact, puts it this way. Et Hashem, kumo im Hashem. As if with. You see, the word et has, the word et's a very intriguing word in Hebrew. On the one hand, it's the sign of the direct object. But also it has a number of other meanings, including with. And Rashi says, when God created me and my husband, this is what Eve said, when God created me and my husband, he created us alone. In other words, God alone created us. But in this case, bringing this child into the world, we are partners with him. So there is the idea that it's actually God who is creating all the time. But in the case of two human beings, a husband and a wife, bringing a child into the world, God permits them to be partners in the process. Otherwise, it would be, as at the beginning of creation, that God created Adam and Eve without any partners in the process. Just he created Adam and Eve. So it's as if the child comes from God, but the husband and wife are partners with God in order to bring that about.
It's a very difficult phrase, the way it's phrased. I get what you're saying. So I bought a man with God? Is that what you're saying?
I acquired, or you could say I created. I think, let me just see what the paragraph
says. She refers to the child, obviously.
Yes, yeah, the man is the child.
Right.
Yes. Okay, kinesi. That's kineti. It's acquiring or creating. I think there'd be good grounds to. You see, in the Rashi, what we were partners with God in creating this child. That's the way Rashi puts it. So the word kana. Kana can mean buying. It's used in modern Hebrew for buying. Yes. But it has many shades of meaning. And so acquiring or sometimes creating. That's bringing into being.
But she's not mentioning Adam here. It's not we, it's I.
Yes. Now you see, it's an interesting thing. Who gave him the name Cain? His name is Cain. Man, Adam knew Eve, his wife, or had known, and she gave birth, she became pregnant and bore Cain, and she said, I acquired, created a man with God. Where is Adam in that process? Where is Adam? Now, the Tikkunei Zohar, one of the volumes of the Zohar, there is the Zohar which covers the five books of the Torah, and there is another volume called Tikkunei Zohar. And Tikkunei Zohar says it was Adam who gave the name Cain. Adam gave the name Cain.
Which translates to, what does it actually mean, Cain?
Well, Cain in itself doesn't have any particular meaning, but it relates to the word kaniti.
I know, but it's not really kaniti.
No,
because
it's not. The ignore is to
purchase. Kana, because the root would be kuf nun hei, not kuf yud nun.
Well, I mean, taking it that the way in which the Bible, the way in which the Torah relates names to each other, they're often at a certain distance. You know, for example, Avraham, in this week's Torah reading, Lech Lecha, at the end of the Torah reading, God changes Abraham's name. And he says, I'm now going to call you Avraham, ki av hamon goyim netaticha. I've made you the father of many nations. Now, Av Amon, it doesn't quite fit into Avraham. Yes, it's a little, it's similar. It's
it's the hay, isn't it?
Yes.
It could be the value of the hay, of the actual letter.
Yes, it's the letter hay, which is changing, isn't it? But here, there's some sort of connection between Cain and Caniti. It's interesting that you say it's not exactly that name. I don't know of any other root. Cain, as if Cain would mean anything else. It could be, but I don't remember offhand Cain having any other meaning. But what is interesting is that the Zohar says it's Adam who gave the name. She said, Kaniti Ishet Hashem. She said, I have acquired a man, a child, with God. And Adam gives the name, says, let's call him Cain. Now, the Vilna Gaon is famous for his textual criticisms of the Talmud and other Jewish works. And very often he would suggest a different reading in the Talmud. And also in the Zohar and Tikkuni Zohar. The Vilna Gaon, of course, was a Kabbalist as well as a great Talmudist. And he suggests that there's a scribal error in the Tikkuni Zohar because it's so obvious that it's Eve who is speaking. Vatomer, she said, I've acquired a man with God. So he suggests that the Zohar should be changed. And instead of it saying Adam gave the name, it should say Eve gave the name. All right? However, as Millie points out, That leaves Adam entirely out of the picture. That's an interesting point. And in fact, there are other commentators who say that the text of the Zohar is correct at this point. And even though, and in fact there is scientifically, one would always support the difficult reading. Textual emendations, scribal mistakes, tend to introduce more simple readings of a text. Because the scribe can't understand why it says this, this looks very peculiar. So the scribe either deliberately or half deliberately changes it so that it looks more normal. So it would look more normal for it to say she gave the name, since the Chumash says, the Torah says she gave the name. So we would say that the Zohar text that Adam gave the name is a more difficult reading because it doesn't fit with the Torah passage that we've got over here. However, if we maintain the original reading of the Zohar, it's very interesting because there Adam comes back into the picture. It says at the beginning, Adam knew Eve, right? So it's Adam knowing Eve that brings the baby into the world. However, the completion of that process is, she says, wow, I've created a child together with God. One of the most amazing experiences in life for a woman, it's to have a baby, and for a man, it's to know that his wife has a baby. It's something absolutely incredible. You know, space flight is nothing. So that fact of Adam hearing his wife say, wow, I've acquired a man, a child with God, he said, great, let's call him Cain. grammar notwithstanding. If you say, you see, Cain is, it's as if you take the two letters Kufnun, which are the essential letters of this word, and make it into a noun or a substantive, make it into a definite name in its own. Mm-hmm. So that's what Kayin, that's what the introduction of the Yud seems to do. It's making it into something. Because really, in fact, the Ivrit way that you make a sale or an acquisition is Kinyan. Kinyan, it's also the rabbinic word.
Yeah.
Kinyan. So that's taking the kuf nun of acquiring and adding a yud and a nun, kinyan. It's making it into a kind of an abstract noun.
Yeah.
And so kayin is another form of such an abstract noun out of the word kana, out of the word kaniti. So there we have the first birth. And if we follow Rashi, that all this was before they left the Garden of Eden. And we take on board as well the idea that this was all on the sixth day of creation, and if they had waited to eat from the tree of knowledge for Shabbat, there wouldn't have been any problem. So therefore all this is happening Friday afternoon, and so Adam and Eve were created Friday morning, let's say, and they made love and had this baby, and then the snake came along and persuaded Eve to eat from the tree of knowledge, and as a result, and she gave Adam, and as a result, they were all driven out of the Garden of Eden. But so the whole process of making love, being pregnant, having the baby, what do they call it in Hebrew? Chikta.
I always wondered, because the word hevel, now we're getting to it, the meaning of the word hevel is not a nice meaning to call anybody, to give it to any human or even to an animal.
What word?
Hevel.
Do you know what it means, Michael?
Yeah.
But
I don't know what it is in English. I don't know what it is in Hebrew. I mean, I don't have the right...
Well, I mean, the famous verse with the word hevel is hevel
havalim. Yes, but what is it in English?
It's a breath. It's a breath of a breath.
No, but the connotation, maybe I'm wrong. Well, in Hebrew, is it? It is a sort of dimness. It's silliness. It's.
I think that's because of the verse Hevel Havalim of Kohelet, gives the word further echoes of meaning. That the world, it's translated in English from Kohelet, from Ecclesiastes, vanity. Vanity of vanities. Mm-hmm. That's the famous verse.
I don't think it is a translation. The word Hevel without Havalim stands as something that is stupefied, not.
Well, it's nonsense. As normal. Hakol Hevel.
Yeah. I mean, Hakol, it's all. Hevel. Yeah.
It occurs in the prayer book. That the beginning of the daily prayers, that really everything is heaven.
Yeah.
Everything is like nothing. It's not so much stupid, it's just like nothing. It's like a breath on the air. Okay, let's read the actual verse. Vatosef laledet et achiv et heaven. And then she gave birth further. Because these are twins. And Vayehi Hevel Roetzon, and Hevel was a person who pastured the sheep, V'Kayin Haya Oved Adama, and Kayin, he worked the ground. Now, let's just examine more clearly this. And it's interesting that no reason is given for the name Hevel, and that's an interesting point. That over here there's no reason given for the name. Just wonder if we have here any.
It's interesting, it sort of all happened in one day, and then we suddenly rush. They were born, and there they are, already grown up, working and
away.
You know, nothing in between, in one sentence. We move on.
Days before television.
All right, so there are these...
oh no, Maite, I just wondered why would a name like that be given to any human? And you know something, he was a human for a very short time, wasn't he?
Because Cain killed him.
He would like to say he was called this because he never lived to have children.
That's very interesting, yes.
Where did you see that?
On here.
Oh, here.
Oh, is it there? Right.
That's interesting.
That's very
All right.
interesting.
Okay, that's nice.
That's interesting, right.
Where does he take it from? Let's have a look. A breath. So that's from Midrash Haggadah. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Oksana. That's lovely.
Yes.
So...
He never lived to have children.
However, there is a further point here. The letters et, laledet et achiv, giving birth to his brother with the word et, and well, there's et Kain, et achiv, et hevel. And Rashi says there are three words et to tell us that there was a twin girl who was born with Cain, and two twin girls who were born with Hevel. So in fact, they're altogether five children. Yeah. So Cain, Hevel, and three girls.
And she had it all in one pregnancy.
In one pregnancy.
That seems to be, yes, that seems to be that they are all born as a result.
It would be in big trouble if that was still the case.
Well, people do have quintuplets.
Yes, they do now with this.
In one day?
Yes. Not in one day, though. Other time.
Yes, yes.
So just that word gives that word it.
That, yes, the word it.
Which is with.
Yes, or it doesn't mean anything because it's just the sign of the direct object.
Yes, et.
Vayikach et ha-sefer, he took the book. There's no, the word et does not translate at all.
Yes. So how did we get to that you had goals?
Exactly, from that word.
How?
Well, when the sages explain a word in the Torah, they have a tradition, or they can see that this word has a certain weight beyond just the simple reading and translating of the text. It also answers a question, which is how did people reproduce? Because you have Adam and Eve giving birth to two boys.
Yeah, they had to do
One of the boys kills the other one. And yet we find the world being populated. So therefore, girls must have come from somewhere. So where did they come? So, if you like, the simplest explanation is that they were born at the same time, because it doesn't say separately that Eve gave birth to a few girls, which could be very useful. But so they must be hidden in among the boys who were born. Mm-hmm. And so there they are, hidden in with the word F.
Still on the text of the word, of the name Hevel, at some point it is Hevel, and before that, but it's a chivet habit.
Yes, now that's what's called the pausal form. You often, for example, if the word mayim comes at the end of a verse, it's mayim with a kametz. Mayim with a patach, if it's in the middle of the verse, but if it's at the end, or exactly in the middle, at the etnachta, you know, the etnachta, the...
Yes, I see. Of course, there are no nekudot chomrim.
This sign in the Torah,
yes,
this is the etnachta,
yeah,
in the Chumash. So in the middle of every verse, you've got one. So, for example, in the middle of the verse that we're speaking about, it is under the word Havel.
Yeah,
yeah. Havel. Now, when you have the etnachta, or at the very end of a verse, you have what's called the pausal form, and the pausal form lengthens the vowel.
Right.
So patach, a, is a short vowel, whereas kamatz, o, in the Ashkenazi pronunciation, is a long vowel. So that is why it's either mayim or moyim, and the same with havel or havel. So in Sephardi pronunciation, you don't really notice. I think the Yemenites would make a difference. You would hear the difference in the way the Yemenites pronounce it. They have a way of pronouncing Hebrew where every single vowel can be heard as differently. and also the difference between a letter which has got a dagesh or not. So for the Bagad Kafat letters, so Gimel takes a dagesh when it's at the beginning of a word, but neither Ashkenazim nor most Sephardim make any difference in pronunciation. But I think the Yemenites do. There's some way in which it's something special. So they have a very pure form of pronunciation. So here we are, that there is Havel, has also been born. And I think that explanation from the Midrash, that he's called this breath, just a breath, just in nothing, in the sense that he didn't live and nothing comes further from him. Although, interestingly enough, we learn something very important from the life of Havel. So let's take that a little bit further. So he... Havel, he grazed sheep, and Cain served the ground, served the, worked, not served, worked the ground. In other words, tilled the soil, grew things. And this is when they were born before being driven out of the Garden of Eden, but then they were all driven out, and now they are all working the ground, or Hevel is grazing sheep. Vayihi miketz yamim, and it was at the end of a number of days, some years later. Vayavei Kayin mipri ha'adama, and Kayin brought from the fruit of the ground, mincha l'Hashem, a gift to God. Now it is Kayin who first had the idea that he is going to bring from the fruit of the ground. And the interesting thing is, there is a tradition that what he brought was flax. Flax. Now flax is a mysterious substance. Flax makes linen. The opposite of linen, spiritually, is wool. Wool and linen garments cannot be worn together. Wool and linen together are called shatness. And shatness is any kind of mixture of wool and linen. And so therefore many people, when they buy a coat or a suit, they look very carefully to see how it is made, and in many cases they take it to a shatness laboratory, which is a 20th century creation, where people take a few strands, like from the lining and different places where there's extra stitching, and they look at it under a microscope to see if it's wool or linen or artificial fiber or cotton or whatever it might be, to see that no wool and linen are being mixed together.
Mixed in the same garment or worn at the same time?
No, mixed in the same garment. In the same garment.
So you can wear a linen shirt with a woolen coat?
Yes.
That's not a problem.
That's not a problem. But if it's in the same garment, and it could be like at the collar of a woman's coat or a man's jacket, very often might have a linen underlay. That the garment is made of wool, but there is a linen something which is lining the collar. So there are a whole lot of places typical of modern tailoring where such mixtures might take place. And the man who is trained in the shatness laboratory, he examines all these places. And he's looking for wool and linen. There are worse problems when the actual fiber is a mixture of wool and linen. And that began to be used in the 19th century. And as a result, there were many people in Eastern Europe did not wear wool at all because they were frightened that it was mixed with linen, and they didn't have microscopes. There wasn't any easy way to find out. So they didn't wear woolen clothes made of wool. They wore silk. So that's where you get the phrase a Zaydan Ayid, a silk Jew. Because it means that he is punctilious about this particular issue. But it was an Eastern European chumrah or concern when the Chatam Sofer was told about it, who was a great rabbi in Pressburg. He said he'd never heard of this before, you know. So sort of a local thing. But it's part of the background of people wearing traditional clothing, including silk garments. So some of it is based on worrying about shatness. So shatness is still an issue, and there's several shatness laboratories here in London where people will test the clothes and make sure, and then they put some kind of sticker in the clothing. Some kind of little shatness label saying this garment is guaranteed clear of shatness. So wool and linen. So wool is seen as the attribute of kindness. Linen is the attribute of severity. So Cain brought a gift which is linen, flax, the origin of linen. Now linen in fact was seen as something very precious. When it says he brought mipri ha'adama, from the fruit of the ground, linen is, there's a high regard for linen. However, in terms of how he selected, what he selected to bring, it is interesting that Rashi and following various Gadic statements says, min hagarua, he brought from something which was from the lowest, not choice at all, not good, not special. So although he was bringing from a sort of a sophisticated type of produce, but his selection of that was not special. It was inferior. He was bringing linen, but it was inferior plants. I'm not sure what linen, what flax looks like in, does anyone know what it looks like when it's growing? And,
I bake bread with flax.
Flax seed.
It's wonderful, yes.
Yes.
And linen is one of the best quality
garments
to wear.
Yes.
The Kohanim wore it.
That's right, yes.
And I heard from Scheinberger, Rabbi Scheinberger, that people today in Jerusalem that go to yeshivot and want to be really kind of, they wear linen because it is supposed to be kind of bring up a Ruach HaKodesh or make us a little bit more elevated spiritually. So, and it's very expensive in Israel. It's not a cheap garment compared to cotton or wool or...
Mm. Right.
Always has been, even here, good quality.
Right. Yes. But in the form, whether he brought it as seeds or as plants, I'm not sure. But the way in which the sages depicted, he brought something inferior. Although it was a sort of a high class variety of produce, but he brought something inferior. Now, it's interesting that it is Cain, there's something poignant about this, that it's Cain who is bringing the gift to God first. And then Hevel sees him. And he, Hevel, next verse, verse 4, Hevel hevi gamhu, Hevel he also brought, mibechorot sono, from the firstborn of his flock, umichel vehem, from the fattest of the lambs. So he is bringing something which is from sheep. Now sheep are not necessarily seen as something so elevated. Linen in the plant world is something particularly elevated. Sheep in the animal world are actually lower than oxen. If he'd have wanted to bring a really, you know, fantastic animal as an offering, maybe he should have brought an ox. But he didn't. He brought a sheep. However, the kind of sheep that he brought is from the best. From the best. Now this sets off a very interesting thing which even enters halakha. The Rambam writes about this. That if you want to bring, to in any way donate something, you want to donate some books, or you want to build a synagogue, it should be the most beautiful. You should, whatever it is you are doing, it should be in the most beautiful way. Now this is called Hidur Mitzvah. I'm going to write it in block letters. Hidur. Hadar expresses splendor, and Hidur mitzvah is the beautifying of the mitzvah. And there is, and the Rambam in fact quotes, Maimonides quotes this passage here in order to prove this concept of having to bring the best. So from Hevel, although he did not have any children, we actually, he taught an important teaching through the generations. And that concept of Hidur mitzvah is enduring. Now, so he brought Mibchorot Tzono from the firstborn of his flock, Umichal Vehen, the fattest ones, and that was in some way the nicest, and then Vayisha Hashem El Hevel. God turned to Hevel, the El Minchato, and to his offering. Now, the way in which this is explained, Yarda Eish, fire descended, V'lichecha Minchato, and the fire licked at his offering. So in the same way that we find, now this is an image we find a number of times in Tanakh, someone brings an offering and they don't light the flame. The idea of the offering is that it's going to be burnt. But they don't bring, they don't light the offering. Fire descends from heaven and sets it on fire. Now here is the first time that we see that happening, that Hevel has brought this offering and fire comes down from heaven. Who can tell me the next time that we see it in Tanakh?
Moshe. No, it wasn't offering.
What were you thinking of? The burning bush?
Yeah,
no, obviously no, so that's not quite.
I can't recall.
Oksana?
Chana? No.
Well,
Oh, was it Akedat Yitzchak?
No, fortunately.
Yes, what I thought.
No, but there was, but he put an eagle, yeah, instead.
A ram
or whatever, yes.
Well, actually, the in the Parshat HaShavua this week, in the Sedra this week, Lech Lecha, there is what is called the Brit Bein HaPtarim, the covenant between the halves.
Ah, yeah.
And there Abraham takes several animals and cuts them in half. And then it says, and God tells him, your children will be slaves in a land which is not theirs, and then at the end they will go free. This is the whole prophecy about going into Egypt and coming free. And then Vayihi Hashemesh Ba'ah, and the sun was setting. Va'alata haya, and there was a thick cloud. Behine tanur ashan, and a fire of smoke. Velapid esh, and flames of fire. Asher avar, which passed bein hagzarim ha'ele, between these two halves. So there, in the Parshat HaShavua, in the Sefer of the Week, we have an incident there where a miraculous fire passes between the halves of this offering. And the next time it happens is when the Mishkan, the sanctuary, is being dedicated, and fire comes down from heaven and sets fire to the offering which was on the altar. And then Nadav and Avihu, the two sons of Aaron, get so excited, they take a pan of incense towards the Holy of Holies, and fire comes from there and burns them. So it's a there's a danger in this whole process as well. And we next see it when King Solomon dedicates the temple in the Book of Kings, and then again he puts the offering on the altar and fire comes down from heaven and sets it and such a delight. And then a little bit later, there was an incident that happened in Haifa. Does anyone remember that incident? Yes.
Eliyahu was in Haifa.
Yes. Eliyahu.
That's what I'm thinking.
Exactly.
But I don't remember what.
And it was a contest. He said...
Ah, yes.
Go on. What happened?
No. Because I'm muddled, but I remember the contest.
Elijah is having a contest with the priests of Baal.
Yeah.
And he says to the Jewish people, he says, how long are you going to... you're going to stand on the doorstep? Is God... the God that you serve, or is Baal the God that you serve? And there are the priests of Baal there, and he says, look, you make a altar and put an offering on the altar and let Baal set this offering alight. And so they do this, and they put the offering on the altar, and they start crying out to Baal, Baal, answer us. And Baal doesn't answer, nothing happens. And Elijah starts making fun of them. There is a certain amount of mockery in the Bible about idolatry. It's interesting. It's a form of biblical humor, and it's about idols. So here it comes out in rather a coarse way. You know, he says, where is he? Maybe he's gone to the bathroom. You know, why isn't he? You know, so that's Elijah mocking the priests of Baal, and nothing happened. The Midrash says that what they were crying out so feverishly, did they really think Baal was going to do anything? The sages can't believe that idolaters actually thought these idols would really do anything. But they had dug a hole, they dug a tunnel under the altar, and they'd sent a man there with a flame who was supposed to light this offering from underneath, which would then be heralded as a wonderful revelation. But a snake had killed the man. So they're calling to him, you know, Baal, answer us, come on, you know, get crawl through the tunnel and set fire. You know, so this is a slightly bawdy presentation. There is, I think it's in Isaiah, where he describes a man making an idol. So he fasts, like an accurate description of, you know, all the rituals that go into idol making, as we see in modern Africa or something like that. Well, they exactly make idols, but the same kind of thing that they do. And he fasts, and he takes a nice piece of wood, and he cuts the wood in half, and he uses half of it to make a beautiful idol, and the other half he uses to cook his supper. So, you know, that's the way, you know, the that mixture.
But this consuming fire, is there something that, how does the Kabbalah explain it? I mean, is it an extra buzz of energy from the infinite, or
I think from the point of view of the Kabbalah, the mystery is that there's so little consuming fire in ordinary everyday life. Mm. It's as if fire is, you know, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and his son, when they were together in the cave for 12 years, hiding from the Romans, but also deep in mystical and Talmudic teachings. And then when they came out, they were amazed that people were occupied in ordinary daily work. Menichim chai olam v'oskim b'chai shah, said Rabbi Shimon. They are forsaking eternal life and they're occupying themselves with ordinary worldly things. And everything they looked at burst into flames. So that was the sort of the look that they had. However, this displeased the divine. He said, are you going to destroy my world? There was a voice from heaven, a bat kol, go back into your cave. So they went back into the cave. This is recounted in the Talmud, Tractate Shabbat, page 32. So 33. No, you know why? Because it relates to Lag BaOmer.
Ah, yes.
So the 33rd day of the Omer, and it's on the 33rd page of Shabbat. It's, because Lag BaOmer, the 33rd day of the Omer, is the yahrzeit of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. So when they came out, so they went back into the cave and they stayed there another year. And finally they came out again. And one said to the other, or Rabbi Shimon said to his son, it's enough for the world, you and me. In other words, you and me know the esoteric truth, and the rest of the world, let them do ordinary things, and don't bother them. But Rabbi Elazar, his son, still had this fiery look, and he would look at things and they would burst into flame, and his father would look at it and the flame would go out. So it was almost like a contest between them. And then they met a man who was hurrying, and he had two bundles of hadassim, of myrtle, under his arm. And they said to him, why are you hurrying? He said, it's Erev Shabbat. I'm hurrying to get home before Shabbat. And then they said to him, and why are you carrying these two bundles? He said, this is to grace the Shabbat table, a Sephardi custom to this day, to have myrtle. And so why two bundles? Because one is corresponding to Zachor et Yom HaShabbat, remember the Shabbat day, and the other corresponding to Shamor et Yom HaShabbat, guard the Shabbat day, which are the two texts of the Ten Commandments, one in the book of Exodus, one in the book of Deuteronomy. And those are the basis of what? Those two terms? The two candles.
30 candles, yes.
That's right. The two candles for Shabbat. The Shamor and Zachor, the two texts of the Ten Commandments, they're the basis of the two candles. So they were very impressed by this dedication to the mitzvot, and they saw that people, even if they don't realize the esoteric mysteries, nonetheless they're able to be dedicated to God through these, the practicalities of the mitzvah. So the idea of fire, they said of the Kotzker Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kotzk, he was a very fiery Hasidic Rebbe, and he lived in the middle of the 19th century in the town Kotzk, some miles south of Warsaw, south of Warsaw. So they said he had bushy eyebrows, and the bushy eyebrows were to protect the world, because otherwise he had such a fierce look that things would burst into flames when he looked at them.
Wasn't there also, when Moses came down after the 40 days, that he was glowing?
Something
to do with that?
Well, that's another dimension of something similar. The glowing face of Moshe, which he had to hide.
Yes.
And he put on a mask of some kind, a veil, because it was so intense and frightened people. And then sometimes he would take it off, and when he taught people Torah. So fire, I mean, that's the fire of existence. And also, given the idea, the way we understand the nature of existence today as being energy, everything is energy, every solid mass is really a potential, and it's an energy locked in there. And so this sense of the flames, the fire, the bursting out of the fire. So certainly the idea that there should be fire appearing at this offering is an expression of divine favor, some kind of connection to the divine. So in the case of Havel, this is what took place with his offering. It burst into flames spontaneously, and this was the mark of divine recognition. But in verse 5, Ve'el Kayin ve'el minchato, but to Kayin and his offering, Lo sha'ah, God did not turn. In other words, nothing like this happened. Vayicha le'Kayin mo'od, And Cain was very angry. Vayiplu panav, and he became depressed. His face fell. He became depressed, miserable about this, and angry, dark. Suddenly, everything, the Welt ist geworden finster. The world became dark to his eyes. Vayomer Hashem el Cain, and God said to Cain, Lama charalach? Why are you upset? Why are you angry? V'lama naflu panecha? Why is your face fallen? And now we have a very, very interesting line. Halo imtetiv se'et. Surely, if you do good, then everything can be carried. V'imlotetiv, but if you don't do good, lapetach chatat rovetz, at the entrance, sin is crouching. Ve'elecha tshukato, and to you is its, her, desire. Va'atatim sholdo, but you can control it. Now, this image, this image of the struggle of man.
But it starts with jealousy, and it's the second time that they were just created, and we have the picture of this snake who is jealous of whatever it is see between Adam and Eve, and then you've got the second human who is already has this need for competition and to be better, and why wouldn't God? I mean, this is a very flawed creation, isn't it? Humans. From the beginning.
Well, the snake wasn't human.
No, but we are. I mean, this is...
Well, it's as
if... And then it goes on.
A key problem in existence is this quality of jealousy.
Of jealousy. Greed and jealousy. There are two qualities that are...
And the jealousy of Havel is the jealousy of his spiritual enhancement. There's something more spiritual about Havel. He was the one that God shone, God radiated to his offering. And so Cain is angry about that.
So we are not descendant from Havel. From that shyness and goodness, we are descended from?
No, we're descended from Seth, from another son.
Not even from Cain?
No.
Of course, yes, there was another one.
Yes. Later,
yes,
after Cain killed Hevel, Adam and Eve had a third son, yeah. And we are descended from him.
So what happens with Cain's descendant?
Well, there are descendants, but the people of Shem and Abraham, they come from Shet. Yeah. So there are descendants from Cain. But the Rabbi Isaac Luria, he said that his soul is a Gilgul of that of Cain.
Really?
And in other words, his life in the world had to put right that first sinner.
He died when he was fairly young.
Yes.
In his 30s, wasn't he?
Oh, I thought 40 something. Yes, certainly. Yeah, he was a very short time in Tzfat. In the time he was
We went there, do you remember? We didn't quite go to his grave, yeah. Couldn't make it.
Right. So here we have in this statement to Cain, the idea that you can control it. A very, very powerful phrase. Let's just look at it again. Halo imtetiv, behold, or surely, if you do good. Now, tetiv is doing good with something, and the targum adds in another word. Tetiv ovadach, if you make your actions good, if you do good action, say it. You can be forgiven. Se'ek literally means you're carried. The idea is God carries us, and when we sin, He carries our sin. He forgives our sin. It's a way of expression. So if you do good actions, you can be forgiven. Ve'im lo teitiv, but if you don't do good actions, la'petach atat rovetz, then sin is crouching at the doorway, ve'elecha teshukato, and it's seeking you, it's longing for you. Ba'atatim shalvo, but you can control it. Now those last words are very powerful. It means we always have the power to control whatever temptation comes our way, which is really a point of deep faith, because a person can imagine that they are being dragged, they're just unable to stop themselves. And yet here is a biblical teaching, and there's a Talmudic phrase which is in Hebrew, lufum gamla shichna. According to the camel is the load. There's never, and this is a real article of Jewish faith, there is never a load too great, because God only gives the right load to the camel which is able to take it. And so therefore, if a person has a tremendous, tremendous temptation, which is the load that they're carrying, this article of faith says, Atatim Shalva, you can control it. We can control it. Now, in some aspects of life, this might seem very mysterious. Can we control it? And we find it very difficult. However, I think what we have to try to do is utilize these teachings, which are trying to give us self-mastery. The problem with Cain is that he failed in this attempt to control himself. He's filled with anger. He's filled with jealousy. He's depressed. His face falls. He's shuddering with rage. And God is saying to him, you know what? It's in your hands. You can control it. But he's not able to control it. And that's the next verse that we have. Now, before we come to that next verse, I would just like to speak a little bit about what it means, control, in Kabbalistic terms. It's getting late.
It's all right.
But you see, the design by the Holy One in creating this world is that godliness should be revealed in this lower world. There should be a world of concealment, and in this realm of concealment, godliness should be revealed. Because before creation, beyond creation, there's no concealment of God. And when there is only God, and God is totally revealed, in a sense, you don't see the full depth of what it means, godliness, holiness. But when we are in this physical world, which is a world of concealment, a world of desire, uncontrollable, seemingly uncontrollable desire, uncontrollable rage, hatred, jealousy, all kinds of different ills which afflicts the human frame, and a man or a woman controls this, that control is the revelation of the divine. And there is a phrase from the Zohar, Kad it kafya sitra achra, it's in Aramaic, when the sitra achra, which means the realm of evil, the other side, is quelled, Istalik yikar de kutshe berichu lechule almin. the glory of the Holy One ascends to the highest world. So in other words, that personal struggle that an individual has here, which can be with the most tremendous, tremendous, really enormous effort needed in this attempt to control it, that's actually revealing some divine quality. So, putting it in very mundane terms, if you park your car somewhere and you come back 10 minutes later and there is a parking meter attendant sticking a, putting a sweet letter under your windscreen wipers, your self-restraint, especially if you have studied martial arts or something like that, the self-restraint which is revealed by just smiling sweetly is without bounds. So that ability to hold back one's temper, that is that's crucial. We are getting a little bit late, and I don't want to go on to Cain killing Abel, because then we will be ending with a rather sad note. So I think it's better if we end at the point where we are just dealing with not sloshing the parking meter attendant, and in that way revealing the divine. I remember I found a wonderful, what I thought was a wonderful thought mechanism for dealing with a parking meter attendant. How sad to have a job which is upsetting people.
Yes, very much so. They get beaten up, some of them as well.
Yeah. But it's so sad that one's whole job is upsetting people. How different to be someone working for the AA, where every encounter with people, oh, thank God you've come, here we are stranded on the motorway, you know, to be welcomed, you know. So, yeah, it's, I suppose they feel they're keeping the streets clear so that ambulances can get through.
I wonder whether that actually crosses their
minds. Well, they may have special training. Listen, guys. But throughout our lives, you know, the power, the problem that is defined in this verse, that there are challenges, and that we can do good actions, or we can be tempted into bad actions, and we can control that. That actually continues all the way through life. The issues may be different. The 18-year-old has one kind of issue, 28-year-old something else, 58 something else, 98 something else, but there's always something. There's always something. And that power of a deep spiritual self-control, which really reveals godliness in the world. And that really, that is our goal, to reveal the divine in this world. So Hebel, who didn't live very long, taught us the idea of hidur mitzvah, the beautifying of a mitzvah. And Cain, who did carry out the first serious crime, not just, I mean, it was grievous, not obeying God and eating from the tree of knowledge, but it did not seem such an obvious crime. But here a real crime is about to be committed. Nonetheless, in this powerful verse concerning him, we learn for all time the power of our choice inside us, which might only be a choice concerning thought. Doesn't even have to be anything visible to anyone else.
Either, yeah.
Am I going to follow that train of thought, or am I going to say, no, I'm not going to think?
Yeah.
And that is a point of revelation of the divine here in this world. And that is our beautiful illumination. It's not fire that other people can see, but it does mean that there is a sense in which there is a radiant glow around the person in a positive way, helping and doing good to others.
Just to get on your last phrase on the Idur Mitzvah, and you mentioned, was it a Rambam who said, I don't remember who it was.
The Rambam, my mom is it.
To give Behidur, and was this just when we give to God? Or is it when we treat each other, or where it is when we give tzedakah? I mean, for other people,
well,
or is it only for synagogues and?
No,
you know,
certainly when giving tzedakah.
So for everything that we do for others, that's what I would have sort
yes.
of said, but it was.
Yes, making it something like what we do for others is itself a mitzvah, and to try and make that the nicest thing. With the giving of tzedakah, there's a story about a lady, she had a lot of coins that she wanted to give to charity. But she spent the night before she gave it polishing the coins so that they
Oh, how nice. Sweet.
that's the expression. There's, just to conclude, there's a rather interesting discussion over here by the Lubavitcher, where he talks about the difference in perception of Cain and Hevel. You see, why is it that Hevel brought the choicest things and Cain didn't? Cain knew that it's correct to bring a gift, an offering of some kind to show one's allegiance, one's dependence on God. But he thought God is exalted beyond the world. Obviously it makes no difference to God whether you bring something nice or something not nice. It doesn't matter to God. Hevel, he thought, yes, we have to bring an offering to God, but God is within the world. And so therefore we have to try and make that thing that we bring to God something very beautiful. Hevel was trying to express the way in which the world itself is an expression of the divine, and that therefore if you're giving something, whatever it might be, it should be in the most beautiful way. To Cain, God is transcendent. God is beyond the world, and so therefore it doesn't really matter what happens in the world. And so in that sense, looking at them in those ways, they are, it's as if it's two mystical pathways. One mystical pathway leads away from the world, ultimately, away from the ordinary activities in the world. The other one leads into the world and says these ordinary activities are themselves holy. So that's the teaching. The difference between Cain and Hevel.
Was he ever punished? I can't remember.
Cain?
Was he ever punished in any way?
Well, yes. I mean, the punishment was suspended for 7 generations, but at the end of that, one of his own descendants killed him.
Ah,
by mistake.
But comes back to you.
Yeah.
and who probably, I'm sure that somebody talked about his descendants today. Who were his descendants?
We were not.
No.
No, but which nations today
yes.
can we associate with?
From today, I don't know.
But from the past, from biblical times?
Would there be a clearing out in the flood?
Amalek?
No. They come from Esav, from Esav.
Oh.
No, they come from Esav.
So in fact, Esav is also from Shem.
Shem.
From Shem.
Yeah.